On this episode of The Big Number, we dive into the stats to answer these questions. What can the league do to combat the blatant tanking that seems to be beginning earlier and earlier each NBA season? And how will the suspensions handed down following the Pistons-Hornets brawl impact the Eastern Conference title race? All this and more coming up right now. Welcome, 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 welcome to The Big Number. I am Tom Haberstroh, and that is our man, your man, Dan Devine. It is post-trade deadline time. We've got the rest of the season in front of us. We got to kind of unpack now that the dust has settled. Dan, how you feeling, man?
Well, right now, I feel pretty good, Tom, but maybe like 20, 25 minutes in, my hammy might start barking. I might need to take just like an early exit and sort of see how the rest of the podcast goes. I hope that's not a problem. I hope that wouldn't undermine the integrity of the podcast.
That's right. It's some tendonitis you might be feeling here as we head into winning time.
My elbow, my knee, my ankle's been cracking. The doctor said I need a bacchiotomy. There's a lot going on over here, Tom, and I'm just hoping we can get it all ironed out.
Yeah, well, why don't we get to it? The big number this week, Dan, is zero. That's how many fourth quarter minutes that Jaren Jackson Jr., the latest newcomer to the Utah Jazz, has played since joining the Utah Jazz. And that's interesting because he has played in two games and they've been close, but he has not played in the fourth quarter. The final frame has had him on the bench. Star player, defensive player of the year. A couple years back, you think you would want that guy playing in those big moments. But no, the Utah Jazz have benched not just Jaren Jackson Jr., but also Lauri Markkanen, also an all-star starter, when it's kind of the lights are brightest. And so this is a really interesting development because the Utah Jazz have a top eight protected pick going into next couple months once the draft lottery happens. And right now they're in the sixth best odds of landing the number one overall pick, and they don't want to lose that pick. And so Jaren Jackson Jr. is not playing the fourth quarter, and neither is Lauri Markkanen. The Jazz are doing something this year, Dan, that the Toronto Raptors did last year, but it was in late March, right? So like we've seen teams take their best players off the floor in these winning moments, clutch moments. But this is kind of a new development in the sense that it's early February. We're not even at the All-Star break, and teams are utilizing this pseudo tanking measure, the quiet quitting, where if you're not paying attention, you might not realize that your team is taking off their best players in winning moments. And so, Dan, we talked a lot about Giannis, and you called it that he's going to stay put. And that was surprising to some that Giannis was not moved at the deadline. But I think this Jaren Jackson Jr., Triple J acquisition by the Utah Jazz was so much of a stunner for me. And I was wondering how they were going to handle this with his minutes. And we have our answer right here with zero fourth quarter minutes since he's been acquired, Dan.
Yeah. And the funny part of it is it did achieve the intended result in the first game that he played where they were up big on the Magic and the Magic wind up coming back and delivering the Jazz one of those tasty, tasty losses. It did not work out so hot in the second game because the Miami Heat just couldn't get out of their own way. They couldn't stop Bryce Sensabaugh. They couldn't make a shot. And so the Miami Heat, despite the Jazz sitting Jaren Jackson Jr. and Lauri Markkanen, and lest we forget, Yusuf Nurkic too. Big glow up for our guy Yusuf Nurkic that he's now considered too good to play in the fourth quarter for the Utah Jazz. It seemed like a couple years ago, I don't know if Nurk was going to be sticking around, and now he's throwing up triple doubles and getting benched in the fourth. Good looks for our guy.
Is that the new
Nurk
status symbol, Dan? Is that like in the locker room? Some stars get two lockers, but what about getting benched in clutch minutes? That used to be like Rudy Gobert and Joakim Noah's nightmare, but now Yusuf Nurkic, it's a badge of honor.
Yeah, he's become sort of like a labubu for the end of Will Hardy's bag. Like it's like a real, it's like a decorative ornament at that point. Just sort of hang out on the end of the bench. I honestly didn't know the labubu was going to come up today. I'm really proud of us both for getting there so early before I have to head out. The Jazz are doing this. It's worth noting. Last year, the Jazz were fined, I believe, $100,000 for violating the player participation policy, for failing to make Lauri Markkanen available for games. And so what the Jazz are doing now is say, We are making Lauri Markkanen available. We are making Jaren Jackson Jr. available. They're just not going to be available for the whole game. And we're going to choose when we decide to prioritize the building of chemistry among our new star acquisition and our holdover all-star forward. And when we're going to say, you know, we really want to get some more late game reps for Ace Bailey and Isaiah Collier and some of our younger guys, because we still got to develop the young guys. You know, that's a big part of our organizational philosophy here. And so they've put the league in a position where it's like, all right, so what are you going to do now? You can say, we're not allowed to, are you going to tell us we can't have our coach manage his rotation in the way that he sees fit? Are you going to take the lineup card out of his hand? What are you going to do? We're making the guy available. He's playing 27 minutes. They're playing the bulk of the game together. So what happens now? And that is, so that's what, it's like an interesting wrinkle in the broader tanking discussion that has brewed up in a significant way over these past week or so. Like, the biggest moves we saw at the trade deadline, with the exception of the Cavs going and getting James Harden, all of the rest of them were teams trading for players that they maybe don't intend to play at all, or at best intend to play a little bit and here and there, but sort of situationally. And that has led to some pretty open questions about what this all means for the integrity of the game, what this all means for how valid the competition is, what's the competitive imbalance for teams that have more games against these tankers trying to hold on to their position, all these sorts of big picture ideas. And Adam Silver is about to go take the podium at Intuit Dome. And here's another thing I'm sure he's going to be real psyched to get asked about at his All-Star Weekend press conference.
Yeah, Dan, this is a huge problem for the league, because it used to just be, hey, this is a competitive thing. This is integrity of the league is we want everyone trying to win games. And that was, in its right, like a very critical thing to make sure that the NBA is having a league in which everyone is trying to win, that the competitive nature is 100% in the trying to win category. But the other thing that is affecting this conversation, which is different than what we had last year. So I mentioned the Toronto Raptors last year. What I'm referencing is Scottie Barnes, who is an all-star, two-time all-star, was the best player for the Toronto Raptors. And you would presume that last year in late games, late March games and late in those games, you would want Scottie Barnes on the floor. But the Toronto Raptors made the decision to pull him and bench him in those clutch moments in the same way that we're seeing with Lauri Markkanen and Jaren Jackson Jr. Did they get hit with a suspension? Did they get hit with a fine? No, nothing. They were not penalized by the NBA. And so if I'm Will Hardy and Austin Ainge and Danny Ainge and Ryan Smith, the owner of the Utah Jazz, I would say, hey, if you didn't punish those guys, then what's the difference than what we're doing? And remember, this also has a precedent back in 2019 with the New Orleans Pelicans. If we all remember the That's All Folks Anthony Davis era, when he was coming into the games and only playing 20 minutes and then sitting the rest of the game because they didn't want to have him injured ahead of trade talks, potentially knowing that he wanted out of there. And Rich Paul, his agent at the time, it was not a great look. However, it wasn't technically against rules. They did shut him down at a certain point. I think there was like 10 games in which he was not playing, you know, fourth quarters or late in games, similarly to what we're seeing with Jaren Jackson Jr. But ultimately, that was, it ran its course, and then he was traded to the Lakers. So the Utah Jazz are looking at this situation and saying, all right, well, if you allow those two instances to happen, then I don't see why we should be punished for it. And from the NBA's perspective, there is one big elephant in the room that happened in October that would change potentially their position on this. There is a gambling scandal. The FBI was involved, right? And a lot of those details in those indictments allege that inside information stemming from tanking games, where guys were being held out of games before the public knew about it, or guys were leaving early in games before the public knew about it. These are not things that the NBA wants to perpetually happen every year, especially not in February. The earlier that this happens, Dan, the more problematic it is, because there's just so many games that they have to monitor. Think about it. If this was happening in the last week of the NBA season, the NBA could have all of its men and women on this, policing this practice. Now they got to do it for 200 plus games that they got to monitor guys playing all the way through a game or taking themselves out early in the game. Like right now, we kind of feel like Will Hardy is pulling these guys out of the game because of, you know, ping pong balls. But we're going to have lots of guys who are coming out of the games early. Wait, is he injured? Is he not? Who knew about this? Is this a real injury or a fake injury? And so all of that gray area is why this is such a big deal. Why this is, I think, the A block in this podcast today is making sure people understand that this is not a great look for the league in light of the indictments, in light of Jontay Porter, in light of a lot of the tanking that we've seen over the years that have been rewarded. I don't want to minimize what we're seeing here, but I think a big reason why we're seeing this happen so early in the season is Cooper Flagg just went to the Dallas Mavericks, and the Dallas Mavericks had the 11th best odds in the draft lottery last year. The Atlanta Hawks got the number one overall pick with, I think it was the 10th best odds in the draft. So I think teams are seeing that if you just have like a little bit of a chance of getting that number one overall pick, or at least get into that top five by the flattening of the odds, it's worth it when you get a Cooper Flagg. It's worth it when you get the number one overall pick. And so I think three reasons why this is happening. One, Cooper Flagg, recency bias. Two, this is maybe the best top-heavy draft in a long, long time. And three, we just saw the Raptors do it last year and there was no punishment. So I think all of these things have created a perfect storm why you're seeing up to 10 teams already in February where you're not really sure if they're trying to win games.
Well, the other thing we saw with the Raptors last season was they made a midseason trade to bring in Brandon Ingram, who had been out in New Orleans and wasn't playing. And there was like, is it a calf? Is it an ankle? He's out for a while. He comes over at the trade deadline. He sits for the remainder of the season. I think everybody kind of understood. It was like, yeah, well, remember, there's a lottery pick consideration here. And so he sits out. And then it turns out, oh, by the way, Brandon Ingram's playing at an all-star level this year. He was just named as a replacement for Stephen Curry to the all-star game. So like, if I'm the Wizards, or the Pacers, I'm saying, well, yeah, precedent again. Like, yeah, we have some concerns about our new former all-star point guard who is a small guy coming off an MCL sprain. Reasonable for us to keep Trae Young on ice as long as we can. Anthony Davis, legitimate documented injury as he's come over. So yeah, like, and the thickest medical jacket of anybody that moved at the trade deadline. Of course, we're going to keep him on ice. Ivica Zubac playing through an ankle injury when he was with the Clippers, rather, as they were moving in the direction of trying to dig out of their early season hole and move toward play-in contention. The Pacers, you can argue that they're not a good league partner for what they're doing. The Pacers can say, well, listen, man, we were at game 7 of the NBA Finals. Our guy played hurt, and we are paying the price for that. This is us trying to make the best of a bad situation so that we can return to that level again next year, maybe get off our back. Where I come down to on all of this, it's also very funny that it's like, why is the NBA so focused on the integrity of the competition right now so that they can make sure that we are upholding the integrity of the parlays? Like that part, I'm kind of having a little bit of a hard time with. Like, we have to ensure the integrity of the competition so that we don't mess up the money part. Because remember, there's that whole big indictment situation that we've kind of forgotten about as the league has kept going, which I'm sure is another question that the commissioner is going to face on All-Star Weekend. Lots of focus on the basketball. Where I come back to with this, this conversation about what to do about tanking spins up multiple times a year. We talked about it right before Christmas when Shams, if you see the tweets here on, up on the screen in front of us, if you're watching on YouTube, the post about the League Board of Governors meeting to discuss what can be done about tanking. We've had discussions about this going back to like, what, 2015, 2012? Like these conversations have been ongoing for a while. And the reason they continue is because the league's system incentivizes being bad to have a better chance at a top draft pick. And in no sport in the world does having a top draft pick, a potential like cost-controlled 18 or 19 to 23, 24-year-old talent, there's nowhere in the world where that is more valuable than in the NBA. And so precisely. The other thing, you know, you mentioned one of the potential fixes that was discussed there, like, well, maybe you can prevent a team from having back-to-back top four picks. And the long shadow there is San Antonio, right? Where you go from, it's Wembanyama, it's Steph Castle, and it's Dylan Harper, right? And like, okay, so should they be penalized for their half dozen year rebuild after 25 years of consistently being in the playoffs, right? I keep coming back to like, all right, you can say that this sucks. I agree. I have to watch the games too, right? It's like, I have to, it's part of my job. And there's a lot of games where you're like, this is not an actual game. And that's a bummer. And that's a bummer if you are a ticket buying fan. It's a bummer if you are otherwise invested, I suppose. What are you going to do about it? We've talked, when we talked about this before December or before Christmas, we kind of immediately poked holes in all of the prospective fixes that they were suggesting. We said that the only real way to do this is going to be to completely like disassociate your standings, your place in the standings from what pick you get, whether it's some version of like Celtics analytics guru Mike Zarin's wheel that he proposed many years ago, which is like, it's just, it rotates but some years it's your year and some years it's not. You proposed abolishing the NBA draft, which I think makes tons of sense, because if it's like whoever the rookie talent is going into an open market, highest bidder making the offer, you had the rookie signing day idea, which I liked as a TV idea they can replace the draft with. I will believe the NBA will move in that direction when I see it. And so we kind of keep coming to these places where there's proposals for, okay, well, we'll lock up the standings on March 1st. Okay, so then we're having the tanking conversation in early February now, right? It would be happening again that way. Pick protections, sure. Okay, limit pick protections. The league goes bonkers about how many trades happen, right? Like we've become a hashtag this league about all the transactional activity that goes on. 72 trades, record-setting deadline, all these transactions, all these players moved, all this money, this contract moved. A lot of that is because you have protected picks and stuff. You know, like if you have fewer, if you're not able to include protected picks or the kinds of protections you're able to make are limited, restricted, does that have a chilling effect on the market? Like, does that Pacers Clippers deal happen if you can't protect the pick in kind of a funky way to that gives the Clippers a shot at a 5-9 selection in this year's draft? Maybe not. And so I don't think the league wants fewer transactions. The league has kind of promoted to us that it doesn't want that. It wants the social media conversation. It wants the chatter. So like all of these conversations come back to like, what is the incentive? And the incentive for teams is I got to get, like, free agency kind of doesn't exist anymore. And if you are a team, especially a team that's not in a glamour market, you are generally speaking not going to win that race. So like, you got to get guys in the draft. And how do you get guys in the draft? You give yourself the best odds of getting a top four pick. And how do you do that? You lose. So like, we have this energy for this conversation. I just, to what end? Where does it get to? And I feel like no one has the answer for that. Something should get changed. Totally. What?
Well, the NBA tried to do the flattening of the odds and then only just made the race to the bottom, inviting more people to that race. Yes, now we're seeing... instead of two to three teams trying to race to the bottom, now it's 8, 9, 10 teams that are racing to the bottom, right? So
because all of these front offices understand the incentive structure. All of the decision makers know the outsized value of getting to, yeah, maybe you don't get to that pick, but having a slightly increased chance of getting there gives you a higher chance of having an out, having a lifeline, being able to move forward. And like, until or unless the system changes that and not going from 25% to 14%, but by going like 25 to zero, or our guy Tom Ziller had made a pitch of like, if you are found to be engaging in like legit, like blatant tactical tanking, you lose ping pong ball combinations. You have fewer ping pong balls in the hopper that can get you up there. That's an interesting hammer to swing.
In spirit, I like that. All right. Role. In spirit. Yeah. Just the execution of like what constitutes a blatant tanking strategy.
Sure.
Where like, are we going to see like rotations by Will Hardy? Like, wait, your rotation wasn't totally optimized to win because you decided to play Isaiah Collier an extra 5 minutes there. Is that tanking, or is saying, hey, Kyle Filipowski, you're going to be point guard for the next 5 minutes just to see if you can. Is that a blanking tanking strategy? There's so many ways that we can kind of, this isn't a Sloan conference where we're just going to have a panel to suggest all these fix the NBA, but it is something that, unfortunately, on February 11th, this is earlier than we've ever had this conversation, is the idea of teams are tanking right now and we're trying to figure out how we can you know, stem the tide. Because if this was happening in late March last year, it's happening in early February this year. How soon before that ripcord is pulled, you know, in December, January next year? So lots here. I don't think that, I mean, think about the quandary that the Clippers are going to be in when they play the Indiana Pacers. Like right now, the Indiana Pacers are, let's see, in the draft lottery odds. What are they? The third in draft lottery odds? Second. Okay. So they're second in draft lottery odds. But if they win some games, they might owe that pick to the Clippers. So if you've got two games left from the Clippers to the Indiana Pacers, you might want to tank those games against the Indiana Pacers so that you have a better odds of getting a number five pick. So the Clippers don't have their pick this year, but they could be tanking in at least those two games because of the weird, wonky incentive structure that in a competitive league, the competition is the race to the bottom for a lot of these teams. And that is something that the NFL has with their NFL draft, but one player, one Cooper Flagg, one AJ DeBonta does not impact as much as one guy in the NFL does not impact as much as one guy, one elite prospect in the NBA. It's just the NBA, they play both ends of the floor. Victor Wembanyama, think about it. If there was if there was a Tom Brady prospect right now, if you want to call Mendoza that, but he was also the best defender in the NFL. That's the type of prospect that you have with Victor Wembanyama. You have a guy who's so good, he's going to play both ends of the floor. In the NFL, that doesn't happen. You could be the best quarterback, but you're going to be sitting for half the game because you're not a special teams guy or a defensive player. The NBA is totally different. There's five guys on the floor and they play both ends of the floor. So the NBA is never going to get away with that. The math is the math. And I don't blame Will Hardy and the Utah Jazz and what they're doing. I don't, because this is a competitive sport. They're trying to gain any edge that they can to find their foundational superstar. They haven't won a championship in their organization's history. How do you do that? You get great players. And the best way to get them oftentimes is to go through the draft. And for Utah, they don't have the glamour market that you can attract those guys in free agency. And I know free agency isn't as big of a thing as it is now, but AJ DeBonta at BYU, a program that Ryan Smith, the owner of the Utah Jazz, supports and is an alum, you would want to get that guy. So I could understand why Jaren Jackson Jr. and Lauri Markkanen are not playing in the fourth quarter, Stan.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, though, Tom. Like, if you're not going to be able to sell success, current present day opportunity to win the championship, you have to be able to sell hope. And a lot of the franchises we're talking about for the last half decade haven't really been able to do that, right? The Jazz, they nailed their draft for years, right? They get Rudy Gobert, I think 27th. They get Donovan Mitchell late in the lottery. Like, they build a winner, a consistent 50 plus win team that could make it into the playoffs, win a round. They never got over the hump, but they got to kind of the end of the line of that era. They paid those guys, they kept them around, and then it didn't get all the way. So they had to make their decision about what do? You retreat and you try to figure it out again. And you know you're not going to get those free agents in Salt Lake City, so you got to do it through the draft. Memphis, they nail their drafts, right? They have the high lottery picks where it's Ja Morant and Jaren Jackson Jr. They also nail Desmond Bane at the bottom of the first round alongside a number of other guys, Brandon Clark, and what they've done sort of lower in the draft there. Building, you know, develop guys through their G League program. 50 wins 2 years in a row, win a playoff series. Things fall apart for the reasons that we all know why things have fallen apart in Memphis. They're not going to win free agency bidding wars. They've got to decide what do? And you have to start over again. Like the Pacers, they got to as close as you can possibly get. They also know they're not going to win free agency bidding wars. And so they took their swing at how do we round out our team for when our point guard comes back. And if that means being a little bit crummier this year, well, all right, we'll go for it. But they're the Wizards have been roughly largely irrelevant for 50 years, right? So and they're going and saying, this is our way to try to get back to relevance is through getting these guys, these like all-star ceiling guys, eventually on the floor for us. But we're also digging out of our predecessors with the John Wall contract and the Bradley Beal contract and the no trade clause and the injuries. Like all of these franchises are like, we can't just say, give me LeBron. Like it's not going to work. So how do we do this? And this is the way. Like, Again, if you want the attitude or the behaviors and the results to be different, the incentives have to be different. And I don't know that there's a real way to influence the behavior of these front offices in a way that's like more competitive without dramatically changing the way the draft lottery works. And again, I'm not talking about slightly flattening. Either nuking it or dramatically increasing the punishments for manipulating it. All of these guys, their job is to try to figure out the best way to optimize whatever strategy they're taking, and that's what they're doing. And the fans of those teams, generally speaking, are largely on board with it because it sells hope. It sells the opportunity for an actual plan, which is why the Sixers process took off the way it did, and so on and so forth. Like, if you can't sell winning today, you got to sell hope, and this is the way that they're doing it. You got to show me an answer. If you're the NBA, show me a better answer than this for those teams, and I'm listening.
Yeah, and so is the FBI, for the record, as people are trying to figure out how to get rid of all those information gaps in the league.
Oh, right.
So the NBA is trying to fix that, and the Justice Department is also trying to figure out how people took advantage of the misaligned incentives in the NBA. So we're going to get to more trade deadline stuff here after the break with Dan. You got three little numbers, your takeaways from the trade deadline right after this. All right, Dan, this week's big number is zero. That's how many fourth quarters that Jaren Jackson Jr. has played with the Utah Jazz, despite playing in two games, which is a really funny development. Also, Wizards, Pacers, we're not really sure. We've never seen, really, this kind of acquiring stars to not play them and a weird tanking strategy. But that wasn't the only stuff that happened at the trade deadline. You've got three little numbers here about the Thursday, last Thursday. It's our first pod since the trade deadline. So what is on your mind, Dan?
Well, first thought is the little number for me is like 7,000. I think that's how many words I wrote on the trade deadline in my winners and losers column. So you can go back and read that. It's on Yahoo Sports. You can go check that out. But we'll start with our first little number this week is actually the same as the big number, and that is zero, which is how many minutes the Cleveland Cavaliers have played without at least one of Donovan Mitchell or James Harden on the floor since the trade deadline. According to PBP stats, 96 total minutes across two games, 41 of them have had both Mitchell and Harden on the floor. Mitchell's run the show solo for 28, Harden has run it for 27, and 0 minutes of neither of them on the floor. That's the stagger, right? That's the aggressive stagger we talked about when we got into the Harden trade last week. Cavs have been at their best so far in the Mitchell-only minutes, to be expected. Harden is still getting his feet wet and getting acclimated to his new teammates, but they've won both games. They're scoring 125 points per 100 possessions with both those guys on the floor, which is, you know, lights out, right up there, top offense in the league. They've won both those games, and Harden came through in a pretty big way in the fourth quarter against the Nuggets, which was a marquee game on Monday night. Finished with 22 points, 10 boards, 7 assists, 4 of those helpers in the fourth quarter, and he hit a game-tying step-back 3 in the final minute to tie it up at 117, set it up for Donovan Mitchell to cook in the final possession, hit the game-winning free throws, and then a big, impressive win over a pretty darn good Nuggets team, even though they're dealing with their injuries. So, we talked about the Cavaliers, the idea was maximize your chances at winning this year, right? That was the argument of going from Darius Garland up to Harden, an older player, but a better right now player. Cavs now enter Wednesday's action, a game at a third place in the East. They get the Wizards, as we talked about, probably not giving it the old college try, and their final game before the All-Star break, and their first game back from the break next Thursday is against the Nets. Ibid. Dunks and threes and unpredictable now give Cleveland better than a 70% chance of landing a top 3 seed in the East. So biggest move for right now of the deadline was the Harden for Garland move, and early returns look like the Cavs are getting what they paid for.
Yeah. Here's a hot take. I think the issue for the Cavs last year in the postseason wasn't about their staggering of Darius Garland and Donovan Mitchell. It was that when they played together, they were getting blown out. You know, it was the fit of them playing together was the problem. And so it is good to see that they're staggering those minutes and they're doing well in those minutes. The staggering, Donovan Mitchell alone, when he was playing without Darius Garland last year, the Cavs were awesome in the postseason. And in the short time that we saw that, And then the Darius Garland-led Cavs with Donovan Mitchell on the bench were actually pretty good too. It's just when they were together, they were minus 10 every 100 possessions, according to PBPstats.com. And so they said, look, we need to do better than that. And James Harden, I think, is an upgrade from Darius Garland. Maybe not for the next 10 years, but an upgrade right now. And he's healthier and more available. So as I wrote for TomDefiner.com this week, the trade deadline acquisition of James Harden, I think, puts them in a pretty interesting position of getting to that number one seed potentially. Now that you see the Detroit Pistons dealing, we'll talk about this later, dealing with the suspensions, the Cavs have the most tank-heavy schedule on the remaining slate of games that they have. They have this Wizards game, and then they have the Brooklyn Nets game coming out of the break. They've got 13 games ahead of them against a bunch of those tanking teams, and that's tied for the most in the league. So the Boston Celtics only have 8 such games. The Detroit Pistons have 9 such games. So they are going to be able to close the gap if they take advantage of this schedule cushion that they have here. So I wouldn't be surprised if they get 2. I would be surprised if they got the number one seed. But now with these suspensions, the Cavs got to be pretty excited about the slate ahead of them and how things seem to be breaking their way.
Another trade deadline takeaway here for our second little number is 4. That's how many teams are now projected to have salary cap space this summer, according to Bobby Marks of ESPN. That's down from nearly a third of the league before the deadline. The 4 teams projected to have salary cap space in the summer of 2026 are the Brooklyn Nets, the Chicago Bulls, Los Angeles Lakers, and Memphis Grizzlies. The Lakers are probably or expected to use a hefty chunk of that to bring back Austin Reeves, but you know, TBD on that. The playoffs will wind up telling us a lot about which direction the Lakers want to go as they build around Luka Doncic. The other teams, though, we kind of fit into what we've been talking about. The Nets, the Grizzlies, the Bulls, all of them, where they are in the standings, read low. And what they did at the trade deadline, which was mostly about looking toward the future, taking on contracts or taking on draft picks to try to figure out what they can build moving forward. These teams don't seem particularly likely to splash a lot of cash in free agency this summer. And I think that makes sense because when you look at the list of likely free agents this summer, it's extremely heavy on guys on the wrong side of 30. You know, you're talking about LeBron, Zach LaVine, James Harden, CJ McCollum, Chris Middleton, Kristaps Porzingis, Andrew Wiggins, Tobias Harris, Fred VanVleet, if he actually, you know, if he moves out of there, he's got the player option. Draymond Green, Terry Rozier, which, you know, Terry Rozier, TBD. you know, Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, Nick Vucevic. Like, there are some younger guys here. Trey Young, I think we're all expecting to see a...
Point taken. Yeah, this isn't a great free agency year, and part of that is because of the pre-agency that we're seeing in the league. And also, if you're a good young player, you're going to be locked up on a contract, and teams are going to want to do that. And so, it makes sense. The Trae Young acquisition, I called it from the beginning, being like that is a salary floor acquisition. Is that they're just trying to add salary they have nothing on the books. They've got no contracts on the books beyond this season, and they get Trae Young and Anthony Davis here. I'm still out on that deal. I don't love that for the Wizards. I just feel like they're getting right back on that hamster wheel of mediocrity that we saw for so long for the Wizards. And like you said, like you're eating into your summer cap space for what? For the chance to have the headache of Anthony Davis. Is he going to play? Is he not going to play? And Trae Young, his defense is such that you need amazing defensive guys in order for him to be a break-even type player. He's great passer, iffy shooter, a guy that can lead your offense, but I have real questions about Trae Young and Anthony. I wouldn't be surprised if they played 0 games together going forward. I mean, just the injuries and Anthony Davis's desire to win games, I don't suspect that you'll see Anthony Davis and Trae Young much next year. I wouldn't be surprised if they were flipped to a contender at the deadline. This is just straight arbitrage by Will Dawkins in the front office there in Washington. Is just saying like, hey, we're buying low on these guys and then we'll flip them to contenders next year, but we're still very much in a rebuild state. We'll see if that strategy works. I don't really think that the strategy of adding these two guys to maybe make the playoffs next year is equally as exciting, but yeah. There's not going to be much free agency action this summer, but look, there'll be trades. The draft will be very interesting. So free agency is not dead. That transaction window will be exciting for trades, I think. But you're right. There's just not a lot of free agency movement. And I think it might be just LeBron going back to Cleveland will be the most exciting thing. And then not much after that.
Which is, I think that's what motivated a lot of the movement that we did see, is like teams doing their work early because they didn't think there was really going to be something they were excited to spend their money on this summer, or that they weren't going to have the opportunity to get those guys. Like if they were under contract, that's somebody that you can't just go out on the market and pick up. So, and that extends to other moves too, you know, like even the Wolves getting Ayo Dosunmu and his bird rights, right? Like the Wolves maybe wouldn't been able to win an open bidding for him in the free agency pool, but they could get the opportunity to sort of figure it out now and help themselves, in this postseason push. So I think that motivated at least some of what happened. Speaking of motivations and what all happened, our third and final little number is 7. That's how many trades the Chicago Bulls made between February 1st and the final buzzer at 3 p.m. Eastern on February 5th. That's notable because 7's a lot of trades in like 4 days. But also in the previous 4 trade deadlines, Arturis Karnišovas had made 1 trade. That was last year, the trade that sent Zach LaVine to Sacramento. So he went from 1 over 4 years to 7 in 4 days. And I think let's sort of lay out what all happened. The wheeling and dealing results in Nick Vucevic, Kobe White, Ayo Dosunmu, Kevin Huerter, Dalen Terry, and Julian Phillips all landing in new places. Anfernee Simons, Jaden Ivey, Colin Sexton, Rob Dillingham, Gershon Yabusele, Nick Richards, Leonard Miller, and 9 second-round picks coming to the Bulls. I believe I have that all right. If I didn't get it right, that's a lot to try to parse through, so bear with me. What is the Bulls now, Tom? What does all of this do? It was a lot of activity. I went in the winners and losers column. I just basically put them in like winners because you went to go buy a Costco. You just did a lot. It was a lot of activity. I'm not sure about the alacrity of it all, though. Where do you see the Bulls now after all of that?
Without hope. That's it. Like, I feel like if you're a Bulls fan, do you feel more hopeful about your future with all these deals and the second round picks than if you are the Utah Jazz fans? If I'm a Jazz fan or a Nets fan or a Wizards fan, they still have their pick this year. I feel like the tanking and bottoming out is going to be worth it because I have a shot at getting an AJ DeBonta, Darren Peterson, Caleb Wilson, Cam Boozer type. With the Bulls, I feel like it's 4 years too late. I feel like this should have been done years ago, and they're now, I guess, trying to race to the bottom. And I feel like this is too little too late for me. I like Kobe White. I like Ayo Dosunmu. I like a lot of the guards that they sent out in these deals, and I'm not super in love with the guys that they got back. I think the Charlotte Hornets got better. Minnesota Timberwolves got better. And for that matter, the Minnesota Timberwolves, I feel like we're a sneaky, really good winner at the deadline because I love the Ayo Dosunmu move for the Minnesota Timberwolves, getting him and his bird rights, like you mentioned, from Chicago. And I also like what Charlotte got in Kobe White. And yeah, he might be a little banged up and they surrendered another second round pick. They had to change the second round pick package in that deal. But I don't understand the plan in Chicago, Dan. So your guess is as good as mine, what Karnišovas is doing. But kind of cycling through guards and Josh Giddey, are you more excited if you're a Chicago Bulls fan now than you were before? Maybe because you got this package of second round picks that maybe you can parlay into a first at some point. But I just... That is the worry if you don't tank, is that you're the Chicago Bulls. Like, that is maybe the most uninspired organization of the last 5-10 years. It just feels like they're perpetually in this, the hamster wheel of mediocrity is just constantly cycling through guys that are going to get you 45 wins, maybe. And we're just going to be in the play-in tournament every year.
Yeah, I think the to the extent that there's a glass half full sunny side of this argument or case, I think it's that you make the move to get Josh Giddey, you sign Josh Giddey. The identity of the team is supposed to be, we play super fast and we try to be a transition team with, you know, big playmakers, right? And who do you have to surround Josh Giddey with? It's guys who can run and guys who can shoot, and then hopefully guys who can defend. Matos Buzelis, I think, fits that, right? Noah Esenge, they haven't gotten to see very much because of his injury this season at the rookie they hope that he will fit that as an athletic kind of big. Jaden Ivey, things, you know, certainly profiled as a downhill, you know, fast-paced player coming out of Purdue. Things didn't work out with his injuries in Detroit, didn't really get the opportunity to take off the way that he would have hoped for. Rob Dillingham, this is like another intriguing sort of second draft guy, fast, downhill, get to the rim out of Kentucky. And it was in a position where he kind of really didn't get to play where he could make a mistake in for a team that was like consistently trying to make the conference finals. So the hope here is you're finding a handful of guys who are like young, fast, can get to the rim to play alongside Giddey. You still have to figure out what wings or bigs can do that. They kind of don't have an answer to that beyond Jalen Smith. And I think that, you know, TBD, we'll see about that. Yeah. But, and now you've gotten, you know, whatever, four, I think it's 14 total second round picks under your control in the years to come, plus your own firsts as you move out of the
Raise
Vucevic
the banner
era.
Raise the banner, 14 second rounders. Let's go.
It's, and maybe it means nothing. Maybe those 14 second rounders don't really grease the skids on any deals, but it at least gives you some more optionality as you try to figure out how do you make deals to put a team, a coherent thought of a kind of team around Giddey. You are going to need guys who can run, you're going to need guys who can shoot, and you're going to need guys who can defend. I don't know that they've got many of those, but it's at least a look-see on a few of them that are young and maybe some more, you know, raw materials to go find some more. I think that's a pretty thin case, which is why I made it as half-heartedly as I did. But Bulls fans, you can never say I didn't make an effort.
Yeah. Well, we're gonna talk about someone who did make multiple efforts in this fight in Charlotte the other night is Jalen Duren,
yes.
Musa Diabate, Isaiah Stewart, and Miles Bridges all suspended. Coming up after the break, we will discuss what that means for the Eastern Conference and the Pistons and the Charlotte Hornets as a whole. Coming up right after the break. All right, Dan, right before we went to air, we got some breaking news here that the suspensions have been handed out by the league office, that Jalen Duren is being suspended 2 games, Isaiah Stewart 7 games, and for the Charlotte Hornets, Musa Diabate, the starting center, is going to be suspended 4 games, and Miles Bridges 4 games. So Jalen Duren, the one who did the mushing, is actually only going to be out for 2 games, half as much as Musa, who got the mush. This is big. I'm just going to say it. This is a big suspension for Isaiah Stewart, who's one of the best defenders in the NBA, and Jalen Duren. 2-game suspension. Interesting to note here is that he is an all-star, and he's not going to be able to fulfill this suspension enough to just be cleared of it at the time of the all-star game. There's 1 game left for the Pistons before the break, and so he will be awkwardly serving a suspension for actual games. Who knows if it's going to extend to an exhibition. I doubt that they'll hold him out of the all-star game. Maybe they will, but this has got really big implications for the East race, and this is why. Cleveland Cavaliers coming, and they are all of a sudden in the running for the number one seed, which I didn't think was possible. But now that you've got two of their best two bigs, Jalen Duren and Isaiah Stewart, are now going to be out for at least 2 games together, and then an additional 5 games for Isaiah Stewart. And they're 6 games away from playing the Cleveland Cavaliers in Detroit. So they're going to lose Beef Stew for at least that game. And if you look at the standings here, they're 7 games back. The Cleveland Cavaliers are 7 games back. The Boston Celtics are 5.5 games back of the Detroit Pistons. And yeah, this is not the end of the world for the Pistons, but they have a really tough schedule. The slate over the next 7 games in which they'll not have Isaiah Stewart. Here's the schedule: at Toronto, at New York, at Chicago, home with San Antonio, OKC, Cleveland, and Orlando. Those are all playoff teams. Oof. With the exception of Chicago, those are all really good teams that they got to play without Isaiah Stewart. And 2 of those games, at New York, at Toronto, they're not going to have Jalen Duren. So this is big implications. And on the other side, Charlotte, they're not going to have, for these upcoming 2 games, they're not going to have Musa Diabate, or sorry, 4 games, they're not going to have Musa Diabate and Miles Bridges, 2 of their core members of the team. One of the great stories in the NBA, the Charlotte Hornets, that's going to hurt their chances of having home court in this play-in or just missing the play-in altogether. So this is a big deal, Dan. Your thoughts on the suspensions at first blush?
First thought was, I understand the why, but it's interesting to me that like Durin, who, and Durin had been getting hacked and whacked around throughout that game leading up to it. But Durin is the guy who kind of like steps to Diabate after the foul. And then Diabate goes and like pushes his head back into her Durin's, and then everything sort of goes nuts from there. But from like guy who kind of initiated the contact to last guy in, it's an escalation. It's two games, four games, four games, seven games from the beginning to the end. I think it's just notable. Seven games, can't leave the bench. Isaiah Stewart, yeah, there's a repeat offender component to it, but also the NBA has been nothing but consistent over decades. You can't leave the bench during the fight. You got to stay put because that's when things get worse. I don't have the specific, you know, game log information in front of me, but I think this might mess up Isaiah Stewart for potentially getting like all defense votes because he's played a number of games below a certain threshold of minutes, right? Like that's one of the things. It's not just, are you below 65 games? It's like you have to play above a certain number of minutes in a certain number of games to be able to be eligible. And I think he's one of those guys where like, even though he's only missed four or five, his minute total is relatively low in some of them.
So yeah, just on that, I think it's 17 to 19 minutes that you're allowed like a couple of those games to add to the total because it's so convoluted. I hate the 65 game rule for many reasons. But one of them is that you have to play at least 20 minutes in order for it to count. But if you play 17 to 19 minutes, then you get like two of those games added to your total, and then everything after that won't be added. So there's three games that he's had 14 minutes, 11 minutes, and 8 minutes. So he's at 48 games played. Three of those are not going to count. So 45 that he's played in, and the Detroit Pistons have, let's see, they have 30 games left in the season. He's going to be out for seven of those. So there's 23 possible. Yeah, he's coming up close.
It's getting tight. And then and also
maximum just, I mean, like, 71 games for him.
Yeah, so getting close, getting tight. And also just like for somebody who is a reserve and you know doesn't play tons of minutes, like might fall below some voters' thresholds. Anyway, so just interesting in that respect. It kind of struck me as funny. When I looked at it, I was like, oh, yeah, well, obviously these teams are going to be in trouble losing two of their core, you know, rotation pieces. And then come to find out, both of them have been like pretty solidly plus in the minutes without these guys. The Pistons this season, 468 minutes with no Jalen Durin, no Beef Stew. They're plus 90 in those 468 minutes. And I think that's, you see the value of having Paul Reed as your third big man. We saw that again in that game. Yeah, B-ball Paul. It's right there in his name. He comes in ice cold off the bench in that third quarter after the Donnybrook breaks out the brouhaha. I think some have said it, whatever fun name for a fight you want to go with. And then he plays 18 minutes, has like 12 points, three offensive rebounds. Like he's just doing stuff all-star Paul Reed. So like you can still build lineups with him at the five. You can rebound the ball well. You can be active on defense. He can be that screen and roll dive man. He has made some corner threes. Like you can still build your lineups there for Detroit. So like if you need to get through a few games, you can do that. And then the Hornets, and this one surprised me even more. And I think points to the like really the transformative value of this draft class for them. They have played 518 minutes this season with no Diabate, who like when he went into the starting lineup, it kind of really kickstarted their season. And with no Miles Bridges as starting four. So 518 minutes without either two of those guys, plus 57. Like they're still good in those minutes. And I think that points to Ryan Kalkbrenner, second round pick out of Creighton, has been a valuable rim protecting rim runner for them. And recently they've got Grant Williams back in the lineup too. And he's, you know, obviously things were pretty disastrous for Grant Williams in Dallas. And then he gets hurt. Having him healthy and back, I think, is going to help them sort of hold down the fort. Kalkbrenner, not somebody that you want to throw out there for 35 minutes a game, but it gives you some options, right? So I think Charles Lee and JB Bickerstaff both have some opportunity here. I mean, weirdly, I don't know if one of the other big takeaways is like, I guess I kind of thought everyone would get a little bit more just because of how like gnarly the fight seemed, like that this sort of, there were some pretty big swings. I guess none of them really connected. So like, that's maybe why, but it just seemed like, oh, whoa, these guys are going to be sitting for a while. So then for it to be from between two and seven, I was kind of like, oh, I guess that's about right. But also maybe goes back to some of the other things we were talking about. It feels a little bit hard to parse what the right precedents for punishment are in the modern NBA. I don't know what exactly gets what, but I mean, the main thing is just like that intensity in that game, I think, made you really excited about the prospect of these two teams seeing each other again come mid-April, hopefully with everybody healthy and, you know, cooler heads prevailing, but not totally cool because that intensity was a lot of fun to watch.
We're not too far away from Toes Smith being a key member of the East Conference race,
right?
Because if something happens to B-Ball Paul, that's their backup, right? They don't really have a fourth guy. Tobias Harris could be starting center if something, if B-Ball Paul turns his ankle or something like that. So it's a tough situation.
Asar Thompson starting five. Asar Thompson as your five.
You know what?
Ron Holland. Yeah.
Let's go. A little GP2 action. Just your 6 foot center or whatever tall he is. I'm not. He could be your center, your starting center. That would be really actually kind of fun. So I would love to see those lineups. So this is big news for the Boston Celtics. Of course, the New York Knicks and the Cleveland Cavaliers. I think they just got a little bit more hungrier for that number one seed right now at Dunks and Threes. The odds of the Pistons not getting the number one seed is just 12% chance of that happening. I suspect that widens here with the news. Probably, I would say a 15, maybe 20% chance that the Pistons, given this upcoming really tough slate without Isaiah Stewart, things could get interesting. And watch out for the Cavs. I keep saying that, but watch out for the Cavs now with James Harden. They got a pretty soft schedule. The Pistons have a really tough schedule, and now they have no Jalen Duren for two games, and no Isaiah Stewart for seven. So, fights, tanking, indictments. Upcoming All-Star game with another Pablo Torre report about the aspiration Kawhi stuff. So lots of interesting things floating around before the All-Star break and lots of injuries before the All-Star break. Doesn't look like Stephen Curry is going to be playing. We'll see about Luka Doncic and Giannis Antetokounmpo for Team World versus Team Stars and Team Stripes at this year's All-Star weekend on NBC. Dan, I hope you get some R&R, sometimes kick back and relax a little bit and try to recharge the batteries for the second half of the season. But thanks so much. I want to give a shout out to our producers today. I got a chance to meet Emmy and Ryan at the HQ at Yahoo last week, and it was really great to see them and thank them in person for doing such a great job producing this show. Pivoting at the last moment with the news of the suspensions coming out. Really big thanks to Brad, Emmy, and Sarah and the entire squad behind the scenes to make the show a reality. We'll be back next week on Yahoo NBA on our YouTube channel. A reminder, this show and all of the NBA shows at Yahoo Sports are now under the same umbrella at the YouTube channel Yahoo NBA. That's the Kevin O'Connor Show, Dunker Spot, and this here show, The Big Number, which will be back next week. Until then, everyone stay safe, enjoy the All-Star weekend, and we'll be back next week.